From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Edgar Cayce, an American prophet, with Sidney Kirkpatrick, our special guest. Well, Israel's defense minister has warned of his country's readiness to act against Iran if it feels threatened. Ehud Barak, speaking in Tel Aviv, said Israel had proved in the past that it will not hesitate to act when its vital security interests are at stake. He spoke as Iran's testing of missiles that could reach Israel stoked tensions between the two and with the U.S. But Mr. Barak added that diplomatic solutions should be pursued before other options were taken up. A new form of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, CJD, may have been uncovered in a handful of patients here in the United States. 10 people have so far died from a very fast-advancing form of the fatal dementia. Patients develop the trademark brain damage associated with CJD, the type not linked to BSE, but scientists believe there may be a genetic cause. Unlike the variant CJD, the human form of BSE in cows, contracted by eating contaminated brain tissue sometime in the 80s and the 90s, the cause of most of these sporadic CJD cases is unknown. At least 127 people in 15 states have come down with the measles. It's the biggest outbreak in the United States in more than 10 years. Cases started springing up in May when more than 70 people in a dozen states became ill, according to federal officials. Most of the victims were not vaccinated against the highly contagious virus. A 21-year-old English woman died after the ambulance taking her to the hospital got lost due to a faulty navigation system. The paramedic attending to Kay Gadsby had to climb into the front seat to help the driver find the hospital, while the terrified 21-year-old repeatedly asked her mother, "I'm not going to die, am I?" Well, she did. The ambulance was called to Gadsby's home after she collapsed. She has long been suffering from organ failure and had a heart and kidney transplant 10 years ago. New evidence has emerged that a high plate of floating ice shelf attached to Antarctica is breaking up in a very troubling sign of some type of climate change. It's called the Wilkins Ice Shelf. It had been stable for most of the last century, covering around 6,000 square miles, or about the size of Northern Ireland, before it began to retreat in the 1990s. On September 3, 2007, Steve Fawcett, the multimillionaire record-breaking aviator, went missing when his single-engine plane disappeared in Nevada. A month later, the official search was called off. As summer approaches in 2008, a team led by Dr. Simon Dugnato will tackle the Sierra Nevada mountains to find the wreckage and put closure to the mystery. Remote viewer Ed Dames on the line with us now. He has pinpointed, along with his team, where they believe Steve Fawcett is. Ed, how are you?
I'm good. And yourself, George?
Good, Ed, good. Ed, will you be able to get your information to this group, or do you need us to help you with this?
I need you, because of the time element, I'm going to need you to pass this if you can. That would be great. My my team leader and his and my field team was up in the area doing a recon 2 weeks ago. This is the same team leader, James, that did the winter aerial survey.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to narrow down the wreckage site to about 150, 200 feet in order to make sure that when we go in on foot, we can establish ground truth. I've got an aerial photo up on your website. Your webmaster posted it, and that circle is about 150 feet in diameter. It's at the bottom of a very high, large bowl in the Sierra Nevadas, which is, of course, what we've been saying all along. Steve is not in Nevada. He's in the Sierra Nevadas. Now, I assume search parties know this. That location, that bowl, it's completely locked. You've got to get up to the ridges, the edges of the bowl, and look down. And the wreckage is about, we're saying it's, the wreckage is about 900 feet below the ridges of that bowl, which are 10,500 feet. So my recon element was trying to look at the best routes in, and they were running in, to high streams because of winter snow melts. So they're going to have to do a technical stream crossing when they go back. I could not go on that recon because I had some very important strategic work to do. But I did last week go and meet with Steve's autobiographer in Carson City, and I did a quick interview for A&E TV that'll air soon on his life and his disappearance. So we're still working hard.
Okay, well, we'll make sure we get this information to this new group, Ed. And about a month or so ago, I had a psychic on the program, and she said that Steve Fawcett is indeed dead, but that she saw that he survived the crash and then was just obviously never found, and so he couldn't get out. Did you see anything like that? Because I know originally you said you had seen him dead when you remote viewed, but had he survived for a while?
Well, those are usually pretty private things that we pass along to the family, but it looked like he survived for a little while, yeah. And
yeah,
of course,
you
can imagine in what state.
Oh, my gosh, that's sad. Okay, Ed, let's keep in touch, okay, my friend?
We surely will.
That's a remote viewer, Ed Dames. In Knoxville, Tennessee, a man says that he was so consumed by the Spirit of God that he fell and hit his head while worshiping. Now he wants the Lakewind Church in Knoxville to pay $2.5 million for his medical bills, lost income, and pain and suffering. Matt Lincoln, he's suing after the church's insurance company denied his claim for medical bills. He said he was asking God to have a real experience while praying. If you go up to the coasttocoastam.com website, look under the feature story, you will see a face found in a log. I kid you not, and it does look like a face. A cemetery groundsman here in the United States has told how he found the image of a human face in a log that he had just sawed in half. Ernest Ward took the log into the office of his local newspaper in Maryville, Tennessee. He told the reporters he found it as he and his coworkers cleaned up some debris from a weekend storm at the Magnolia Cemetery. And I kid you not, it does look like a face. Matter of fact, it looks like the face on the Shroud of Turin pretty close. Well, you go take a look at it. Crystal skulls in the news again. The Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History is putting its crystal skull on display. What does this all mean? Because there are some who say this skull is not real. In a moment, we'll talk with Richard Schafsky about it on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Schafsky was introduced to the Mayan crystal skull under guidance of the founder of the Crystal Skull Society and a Mayan shaman priest in Mexico. He then embarked on many life assignments, and his diligence and trust in the process has made him an evolved problem solver in many diverse arenas. Guided by communications, he believes from the crystal skulls. Richard has had a life full of study and research. He's with us this hour as we talk about the Smithsonian skull and some other related ones as well. Richard, welcome. How are you?
Good evening, George. I'm fine. It's a pleasure speaking with you once again from up here in the big sky country of Montana.
Oh, and I trust all is safe up there, huh?
All is safe up here, George. I am hooked up, ready to go, and we're really looking forward to this time we're going to get to spend together with the skulls and perhaps some information that can give you and the listening audience an update of what we've been able to cover since I was last on.
Excellent. Now, this Smithsonian skull, tell me about it.
Well, this Smithsonian skull, George, I'm not really sure that it is what we would classify as an ancient crystal skull. I haven't worked with it specifically. It is certainly one we would call a old or not modern crystal skull. The ones that I would be able to say for sure that we could classify as ancient, which really don't have a timeline of manufacture or a methodology of manufacture associated with them, would be the four that we know is the Mayan and Max, who you've had on the show, Shana-Ra, and the Amethyst skull, which Steve Baylor had talked about. Now, those four skulls, we could say, definitely are ancient. When we look at the Smithsonian skull, there are some indications that some what we might call fairly modern in the last few hundred years tools had been used, at least on part of it, for in perhaps just enhancing an aspect of it. I don't think that's enough to really say that it is definitely a modern skull, because there are also many aspects to it that do tell us that this has some real ancient or old times associated with it.
Richard, I've been looking at this Smithsonian skull, and it looks pretty pristine, almost too perfect, if you know what I mean.
Yes, it does. It has if you look at the Smithsonian skull compared to, let's say, what the other ancient ones are, you'll notice there is a distinct difference. The Smithsonian skull, as you point out, George, it is very pristine, which is something that calls into question, really, what its correct genealogy really truly is.
Now, tell me more a little bit about this skull, and how did the Smithsonian get it, Richard? Do you know?
Well, you know, there are a number of stories as to how the Smithsonian came upon the skull, and in fact, there are different related stories associated with most of the crystal skulls that are in the possession of the museums. There's the Smithsonian skull, there's the Mitchell Hedges skull, which there's a great deal of controversy about right now as to how that really came out into the public eye anyway. Then there's the skull that's in the Museum of Man, which I have seen in London. And I really couldn't say what the real story of how the skull in the Smithsonian, how it came into the Smithsonian's possession, I think is very well documented. However, what occurred prior to that, I really don't think there's a clear picture.
How come the Smithsonian is taking it at face value, Richard, that what they may have may be authentic? I mean, this is very strange for them. I mean, they normally do incredible due diligence. You know, even when they get bones of dinosaurs, they check these things out. This thing, they just seem to accept. They got it 16 years ago, and they seem they're putting it on display. They're going to keep it on display until September 1st. How come they don't seem to question it?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of a sign of the times, if you will. Up until this year, the crystal skulls were not really recognized as being authentic, number one. Number two, they really weren't in the public eye. Now, this year, specifically within just the last couple of months, since the opening of the Indiana Jones Realm of the Crystal Skull movie, all of a sudden we have several hundred million dollars of promotion going on about the crystal skulls. And for the Smithsonian to come forward with this particular skull and really not do, shall we say, the due diligence groundwork that they would do with, as you mentioned, a dinosaur bone, that is a bit of a puzzle. But I do think they have something here that they can put out to the public. It certainly is going to draw attention. It's a great draw for the kids and us children that are adults also, but to come in and be able to view it. So I think we have to look at it. This is a drawing ticket. This is going to bring in some people, and of course, when you have people coming through the doors, you're going to have some revenues. And when we take a look at the revenue streamway that the crystal skulls are creating right now, I think if we follow the dollar, that's probably going to give us the answer as to why they are coming forth with it as they are at this time.
You may be right, Richard, and I think with this tie-in with the hoopla with the Indiana Jones Crystal Skulls movie, I think they think, well, why don't we do it? It's pretty promotional. I remember when King Tut, when they had that exhibit, the boy king, when they had that going around the country too. I mean, it helped museums all around the United States, so this sounds like it could be the same thing.
Well, I think it probably is, George, and I'm not really sure that there's anything wrong with that. Although, if we want to look at a museum as being something that is going to present authentic materials to the public, we might have to challenge that a little bit. But, you know, museums are dependent upon benefactors, and it is those benefactors that are walking through the door with, you know, some amazement in their eyes and some coin in their pocket. That is what is going to help keep those doors open. So I think in today's world, we have to kind of have a little bit of a respect for that, because not only are there this crystal skull in that museum, but the Smithsonian has so much to present to all of us. We have heritage of our planet, of Mother Earth there. And if we can can have something draw in through a crystal skull, I say fantastic. If that's the draw card, and if we can maybe illustrate some of these other tremendous venues that they have, I say so be it. I hope it helps keeps the door open.
Me too. Now, how many crystal skulls do we know of that might be in existence around this planet, real or otherwise, but people think they're real?
Well, we have, I would say there's probably somewhere in the area of 8 or 9 that certainly have some authentication associated with them that could say that they are real. Now, when I say real, I mean that they are not of our modern time. And when I say modern time, I'm talking about maybe in the last 150 to 200 years. We have 4 skulls that I know for sure, and again, that would be the Mayan Max, Shana Ra, and one of the amethyst skulls that quite clearly are of ancient origins. And these go back not just hundreds or thousands, but tens of thousands of years. And their genealogy, I think, includes probably off-planet entities. Their method of manufacture, I don't believe that we have an understanding or a comprehension of today. Now, we have some other skulls that are certainly very intriguing. There is the Smithsonian skull. There's the skull in the Museum of Man in London. There is the Tibetan skull. There are also 3 other skulls that I am aware of that are not really part of the public the public venue at this time. There is a rose quartz skull that is, I believe, at this time in Guatemala. Kind of goes between the borders of Guatemala and Honduras, and that is in the possession of some Mayans. Now, that one, I'm sure, is also an ancient skull. We could classify it along with the other 4 that we know are. So that gives us 5 ancient ones. I would say the Tibetan skull has some real potential to be of ancient origin. And then we have the Smithsonian, we have the one in London, and we have several others that have come to light. There are some that are discussed in the book that just came out with David Childress and Stephen Mailer, Astonishing Portals to Man's Past. And that's where there is a very good historical perspective given to several of the skulls. I would recommend that as a real mandatory read for anybody who wanted to get a clear background on some of the skulls that are certainly old or classified as ancient. And that also gives a real good history on the work that was done by Nick Nocerino, our dear departed friend who
yes.
Still in real communication with.
He was one of the best, was he not, Richard?
You know, my personal feelings along, I would say he was the best, George. I have a very deep continuing affection there. And I have to say that Frank, alias, also known as Nick Nocerino, he introduced me to the quantum world. And I remember that word surfaced 30 years ago. And today it is passed around quite liberally. And I remember back 30 years ago, Frank said, well, this is a quantum tool, when we were talking about the Mayan skull. And so that was my introduction to the world of quantum physics, quantum mechanics, quantum communications. He was certainly unparalleled by anyone in the arena of historically uncovering the meaning and the true history of the skulls.
What's the fascination of the power behind the skulls, Richard?
Well, I think there's a fascination within the power, George, that's maybe not so much the fascination of the skull, but it's the fascination with what it can open up for us. You see, we are part of a galactic community that is in communication, and these tools, these communication tools, the crystal skulls, this is one aspect of what they are. So when we want to take a look at ourselves and our relationship to the rest of the galactic community that we are a part of, at least in this local neighborhood, we have a fascinating tool here that can introduce us, you know, right straight into the direct communication lines with those that are perhaps more advanced than we are.
All right, hold on, Richard. We're going to be right back. We're going to take phone calls with you as well with our guest this hour, Richard Schefsky, as we talk about crystal skulls. I'm sure you have a question or two. Let's open up the phone lines. We'll be right back. And we're going to take your phone calls in a moment with our special guest this hour, Richard Schefsky. And next hour, Sidney Kirkpatrick joins me as we talk about Edgar Cayce, the great American prophet. We're with Richard Schefsky. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Richard, have there been any reports of people touching a crystal skull and something happening to them, dying, getting sick, bad luck, anything like that?
George, I've never heard of anything so far as bad luck is concerned. I can say from my own personal experience, and I would speak also for many who have, we'll say, worked with the crystal skull, that you can certainly have a lot of profound openings occur that will expose you, can expose your intellect to the grand view that is truly out there. There's so much for us to learn, so much for us to participate in. But so far as somebody coming up and touching a skull and then having bad luck befall them, no, I have never heard of that. I have never known of that. There are some who say that the skulls have been used for nefarious purposes in the past against others. There are some that we would call dark workers, dark working mentalistas, that we could have a whole show about what they do. But so far as any of those people being active today, I'm not aware of any. And so far as any acts of harm being perpetrated against anyone, I am not familiar with any of those at all.
To the phones we go. Let's go west of the Rockies. Tuesday in Phoenix. Hey, Tuesday.
I have a question regarding my crystal skull. I have a rather large one, contemporary, recently constructed in Brazil. When I first adopted it, it had no rainbows. Since I have been working with it for the last several years for healing, it has developed rainbows, and these rainbows move around the skull. My question is, why is that, and how can that be?
Well, you know, if we look at what the skull is, you have an alignment of ions that take place within the skull itself that are within the quartz crystal that the skull is made of. And that can draw out many different vibrations out of the air, for example. That's what allows us to be able to speak on the phone with each other right now. It's what runs a computer. It's what a radio can be based on. Now, your body emanates many, many different frequencies, and these can be tied to your emotions, to your intellect, to your physical well-being, to your environment. As your crystal is exposed to your particular environment, and with your hands on it as you begin to work it, you will see formations take place inside. The rainbows generally are going to represent different aspects of your own personal aura. And I would say don't allow others to really work with it or handle it until you really have a firm print of yourself in there. And good luck. You will continue to see these developments take place. You'll develop more mirrors inside, enjoy them, and learn to know and understand what they mean for you personally.
Thank you.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Amy, you're up with us. Go
hey,
ahead, Amy.
George, hi. How are you? This is Amy from Chicago.
Great.
And we've spoken a couple of times. I think you may remember.
Yeah.
But anyway, my question for Richard is, you mentioned there was one skull still in possession of the Mayans, I think in Honduras. And do they follow the ancient traditions in using their skull, or how do they use it?
Well, the ancient traditions are pretty much just that, ancient, and they are a part of history. Today, those that have possession of the skulls, basically what they're doing is keeping them in safekeeping, and the different shaman, the shamanistic lines that were here with us to work with those skulls correctly, they are all now deceased. So, you know, and that's not to say that there is anything wrong with what the people are doing with them down there now, but as far as I know, there aren't any real shamanistic tradition from the ancient past being paid attention to today. They're just that lineage, unfortunately, is gone.
Oh, that's a bummer. So today, the keepers of them are using them for more modern shamanistic healing practices, communication with extraterrestrials, as you
hinted before. I think that's sure. That would be something that would be ongoing, I would think, on a daily basis with them. And you know, for the healing purposes, it's not really what the skulls will do is, or somebody who is working with them will bring you into contact, let's say, with the correct recipe or formulation that has to be presented for a healing to take place. The healing's not going to really take place from the skull itself.
Okay, so the skull is almost more of an amplifier or a receiver.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That you empower with your aura, or is it just like by laying hands on it, it takes energy from you to do it?
Well, you know, it's a reflection of oneself, and the more trained and disciplined an individual is, of course, the more that they would be able to work with it and to be able to do something, you know, correct with it. If a person is a trained healer, then they would certainly be more sensitive to what a healing protocol should be, let's say, for a particular ailment, and their sensitivity to a message that might come through to them, you know, it would be more profound, let's say, than for somebody who is not familiar with healing protocols.
Richard, how did you get interested in crystal skulls?
It was put upon me by Frank Nocerino. I first became interested, George, when, we go back to the early 1970s. And at that time, I was introduced to Frank Nocerino, who assisted me in locating a lost shipment in a warehouse. I was working for a transport company at the time. And then in my first visit with Frank, he put a picture in front of me, and it was of a crystal skull, and introduced me to the world of crystal skulls at that very moment, said I was going to be working with them, and I would soon be in Mexico. That's when the journey began. At that time, I did not know that I was going to be in Mexico, but I most certainly was. And that led me into the world that has existed for me since then, which there was something I wanted to bring up that's really current information that I think we should communicate over to the listening audience, especially up in the Seattle area. I've been working with the crystal skull, the Mayan crystal skull, for over 30 years now, and the communications I receive, they're quite clear. And I had mentioned on our previous show, on the Cinco de Mayo show, that there were some upcoming earth changes in the offshore of Seattle. Well, that has become more and more and more profound in coming through the expression. And we should understand that where the three plates come together, the Juan de Fuca plate, the Pacific plate, and the North American plate, that is set up. It's almost a mirror, exact replication of the fault system that exists that set off the Indonesian tsunami that we had occur just a few years ago. And there is a big increase right now in seismic activity that's taking place off our north Pacific coast. There is also also a tremendous increase in the seismic activity of Mount Rainier. And the communications I am receiving are saying, I would ask our listening audience there to please be prepared for some upcoming Earth changes. We're at that particular place in our orbital galactic spin right now. And I think some of your other guests most recently have also referred to this, that there are some upcoming Earth changes that are going to be quite profound between now and 2012, which is the Mayan calendar. The pressure that is existing up off our north coast right now, by the way, that is also going to put a echo pressure, we'll call it, on the New Madrid fault line, which is went through and is just
right where I am,
right where you are in your beloved city of St. Louis. And I would ask that, George, please, everyone that is up on our north coast and certainly south, just a little bit south of St. Louis, okay, on the New Madrid fault line, please be prepared for, let's say, a few days where there might be some difficulties getting food, water, power, electricity. Have your radios so you can get communications. And if we take a look at what occurred, for example, in the big earthquake in China, that's where a big bowl of water, which was from that Three Gorges Dam, that put a tremendous pressure onto a fault zone there. And when we put our Earth orbital spin onto it, that created a pressure which created a serious fault slippage to take place. I also think there was an influence of some scalar waves in there, which were man-made. But those same type of pressures are now existing on the New Madrid fault line just south of St. Louis and also up off our North Pacific coast. So please, everybody out there, pay attention. And this is not a doom and gloom scenario, but please take your time and be prepared.
Let's go next, Tom in Toronto on the international line. Hi, Tom.
Hi, it's Tom from Toronto.
Yes, sir.
Hi, George. Hi, Richard. Thanks for taking my phone call.
It's a pleasure, Tom. What can we do for you tonight?
I'm glad you're back because I didn't have a chance to talk to you last time when you were on with George a few weeks ago. I have a replica of a crystal skull, but it's a quite small one. It's the size of my fist.
Uh-huh.
And when I meditate around it, I hear phrases from it, and it's saying, "The water is warm." But when I see it, the visual of that, I see a large mass body of water like a lake or an ocean or a very, very large river. Mm-hmm. Do you think that might have something to do with global warming or the climate changes that might be coming? I'll take your answer off the air, and it's been a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Go ahead, Richard.
Okay, thank you for that, Tom. There could be several interpretations in the answer there. And, Tom, I would suggest that if you have any familiarity with dowsing, with a crystal pendulum, that I would suggest you use that in conjunction over your crystal skull and ask for the yes-no answer. A yes being represented by a straightforward and a no being represented, let's say, with the side-to-side swing of the pendulum. And I have found that as you become more familiar with your crystal and as you work with a pendulum with it, you'll be able to ask the correct yes-no questions and quite amazingly get a correct answer.
Okay, next up, Matt in St. Louis, hometown. Hey, Matt, go ahead.
This is Matt from St. Louis.
Sure.
I've been reading in a couple of different magazines, Smithsonian or National Geographic, that they have really not proven, you know, the skulls examined have all been proven to be of, quote, modern origin, you know, due to tool marks and things like that. I was just wondering, you know, where I could find more information out about these skulls.
Well, I would suggest the reading. It's called The Crystal Skulls, Astonishing Portals to Man's Past by David Childress and Stephen Naylor, both of whom have been guests with George here on Late Night Coast to Coast. The book has just been published within the last few months, and that is where I would recommend everybody begin, and that would give you a good introduction to the crystal skulls. It'll help you determine for yourself which ones perhaps are ancient, which are modern, and which we might call old.
Richard, have you ever seen the Smithsonian skull up front?
No,
and personal?
No, I have not. I have not seen the Smithsonian skull up front and personal. What I have done is I can work through the Mayan skull with other skulls, and that's another conversation as to how that is done. But in my work that I've been able to do through the Mayan skull, the Smithsonian skull does not appear to be ancient. It does appear to be what we will call old. It's certainly not modern. But so far as having worked with it directly up close and personal, no, I have not.
Let's go to first-time caller Delbert in New York. Hey, Del, go ahead.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chesky.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Okay, I'm fine. I just wanted to know, there's a KT extinction now that occurred in the Yucatan Peninsula, and these crystal skulls seem to be found there. And I also noticed that when you have things or natural catastrophes or anything that are big and cataclysmic, like the Noadic floods with the Nephilim and or whatever, I want to know if there is a correlation with the finding of the crystal skulls and the fact that a natural disaster had occurred there, in that the crystal skulls, they say, when you interpret them or you're getting visions from them, they do show natural disasters. And lastly, as Area 51 is in correlation with Mount Hermon, is there a correlation or geographic correlations with Chichen Itza and Mexico and maybe where the pyramids are?
Okay, well, in answer to the question, so far as Earth changes are concerned, what I've been able to observe myself personally with the through the ancient crystal skulls is, we'll call them extreme Earth changes, where we go from one era to another. Let's say where the orbital spin actually changes, where you see ice sheets, and then they are of a different configuration. They have a different placement, and these are extended over quite long geologic times. Now, so far as the alignment with the temples and the pyramids in Mexico, Central America, with those on other parts of the globe, there have certainly been a lot of studies that show there are correlations that relate to the different Earth meridians as well as the different constellations within the zodiac. And that is a lifetime study for anybody who wished to investigate it. I don't really know myself personally that there's anything so far as the crystal skulls are concerned with those particular alignments. That is something I think we would probably have to have a whole investigative series take place, and that's a discovery I don't believe anybody has really ventured into at this point.
And what keeps pushing you, Richard Chafsky? What are you looking for?
George, we're at the most exciting time, I feel, in Earth's history. There was a reason why I was sent back up here by the Mayans 30 years ago, and that was to come forward, communicate to the masses, as I was told. And before being able to come onto the show, I had absolutely no idea how I was going to do that. But what keeps pushing me is that I see that we have these changes that are coming up on us. They do relate directly to the Mayan calendar as it was presented to myself down there. And what we want to do is what we should do is do everything we can to alert our fellow man as to what the current Earth changes are, what the political changes are, what these ramifications mean to each one of us individually and as part of a global society so that we can interact with each other. Our survival, George, is truly at stake right now.
And there's no doubt about that, Richard Schafsky. No doubt about that at all. Thank you so much, my friend, for coming on to talk about the Smithsonian Crystal Skulls and the others. And we'll be back in a moment as we talk about the life of the great American prophet, Edgar Cayce.